I'm Vance S. West from TrinityScience.com, and you're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Just when you thought it was safe to get drunk, then say hi to your friends.
Drunken Dialing.
Just when you thought it was safe, make that late-night booty call.
Drunken Dialing.
There's a kangaroo kickboxing in my body.
www.drunkendialing.com.
Good night. Say goodnight, dummy. Jeff Walmsley, BossmanLives.com, and co-author of Bossman Facts Behind the Legend, and you're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Ghostly Talk, sticking our nose in the world's business.
What happened to your journalistic responsibility?
What do you mean journalistic responsibility? I talk about aliens for crying out loud.
Yeah? And what do you think aliens are?
Why talking about this kind of stuff?
Aliens'
responsibility is usually holding the truth back. I'm trying to bring it back out to people and let them see these things.
There you go.
I think we got one vote on your side, Clyde.
What are you talking about?
Well, you do. A lot of people are on my side, I think.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Now you've got Doug, that's me.
Will.
Yes.
And Bonnie.
Well, hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Doug.
Welcome to Ghostly Talk. excellent. What we've been talking about is remote viewing with Paul Smith. And Paul, are you in the mix?
Am I in the mix? Oh, yes.
You are in the mix.
Yes.
I like to hear that. we had a few seconds to chat, and then... and then we all ran and did our stuff, and then now we're back, and we're talking about open remote view. Well, no, we're talking about remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Smith, you wrote at least a book, right?
Yes, in fact, that's one of my main interest right now is the book that my publisher released just in January. It's called Reading the Enemy's Mind, and available Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all of those places. I got to make my publisher happy and let people know about that. It's my take on remote viewing, but it's a bit bigger than that. There's a lot of history in it. People say, I don't read any more history, but frankly, the real history of the program really hadn't been well documented. And, so it's partly that, but also there were cries, let's say, from the remote viewing community, from people who wanted to know how it was used, wanted to know what makes it work, wanted to know what does it mean, all those kind of things. And I try to answer all of those questions in the book. So the history is just kind of like this armature that I hang all of this other interesting and useful information on for people who are intrigued by it. So,
Reading the Enemy's Mind by Paul Smith then. Amazing. Well, but it's not technically reading the enemy's mind, is it?
That's a good observation. It's not. That was a cool title that got people's attention.
It does. It does. It gets my attention. I mean, they call it on what, Sci-Fi Channel or something? No, on Court TV or something, they call it Psychic Spies.
Yeah.
Which also really catches your eye.
Yeah, it does catch your attention. You know, the whole issue of whether it's psychic or what does psychic mean, you know that word has gotten so much baggage attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why we talk more about remote viewing than we do about being psychic. But you can't avoid the psychic word because, you know, that's kind of the only one available to that people understand uniformly what the heck you're talking about. You know, so.
Because in a nutshell, what you're doing is you're retrieving information that is not available to you through your five normal senses.
Exactly.
So therefore, it falls into the word psychic.
Yes. Yep. And it does seem to be strictly a mental thing. It's not like, you know, they've identified, I don't know, 24 different senses in addition to, you know, our regular five.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the, you know, magnetotropism, you know, where you have a sense of magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about, you know, detection of infrared, that kind of thing. This is not a sense in that sense. Okay. It's, ESP, extrasensory perception, another way you could put it. It goes through the perceptual channels, But it doesn't require a carrier that we can identify of any sort. You know, all the other senses do. You know, vision requires, you know, electromagnetism. Smell requires chemicals, airborne particles, things like that. This, you are able to obtain information in some as yet undisclosed way from a target that's distant from you, shielded from you by intervening obstacles, or on the other side of the planet, or in the past, and even to some degree in the future, which we can talk about in a little bit, all without any kind of sensory connection that, you know, that in the normal sense of that word. And, you know, it really is a sort of a form of ESP, or being psychic. It's amazing, and it does work, believe it or not. A lot of folks don't believe it. In fact, the government program that developed this was canceled in 1995 by a bunch of skeptics, and their report said that it was never used, never effective in remote viewing. Some of your folks may have even read that report. Remote viewing was never successful in intelligence work. Well, that turns out to be false. And in fact, if you read the report, you find that in the body of the report itself, it says they only examine 2% of the operational data. So how can you conclude something wasn't useful if you don't look at the data that it would have, you know, that would have been used, right?
Well, anyway. I keep coming back to the time that it wasn't you. It was a different... I can't remember who it was, but somebody telephoned Washington and told them that... Oh, gosh. I'm thinking of a specific newspaper article. Somebody had telephoned Washington and told them about a meeting that was going on. He remote viewed this through the through a window. So he was telling them about a meeting that was happening, and it had to do with bombs and things like that. And at the time he was on the telephone with them, they were receiving the information exactly at the same time from the normal intelligence channels.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that story myself.
It was... Wait a minute. It's somebody extremely famous. not Ed Danson. Not you. Not as... But on your levels, I can't think of his name. McMonagle, Joe McMonagle.
Well, that's a story from Joe I hadn't even heard. Don't have to ask him about it.
Well, what I'll do is I'll dig out the link, because I keep all that stuff, and I'll link it up. I could be, you know, misinterpreting the article, but it did involve he called the folks in Washington. And they're like, nope, nothing like that's happening. You're insane or whatever. and then sure enough, they received the information.
I'd be very interested in seeing that. Joe, of course, has done some amazing things. I mean, mm-hmm. There's the famous Building 402 in Severodvinsk. I can't even pronounce it. The Russian naval base up on the Kola Peninsula. You know this story, don't you, about the submarine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was amazing. Where, you know, where he described inside of this building what turned out to be the world's largest submarine. At the time when the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who had tasked him to do it, believed it was something else altogether, and they rejected the idea that it was a sub. And it turned out to be the Typhoon. He was absolutely right on it, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, I was just looking at those sessions the other day. They, you know, the CIA has released this huge body of data from the program, and in my goings through all of these 90,000 pages of documents, I came across the actual sessions, the sketches, you know, the verbalizing, all of that stuff that Joe did on the Typhoon, and it's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there in those documents.
That is just, and that's the kind of stuff that I mean. Did Joe, and even, well, you said yourself you were skeptical about it because you had tried it for some science fair project and nothing came of it. Then did Joe ever do you know if he ever thought going in, you know, this is pretty crazy or this,
well,
maybe it'll work?
Well, he had a near-death experience some years before, and so he was perhaps not as surprised by it as I was. So, you know, I don't know that he'd had any so-called psychic experiences other than near-death experience, which is pretty profound anyway.
But what's fascinating is that shows that a couple of people were pulled into this project from completely different backgrounds, completely different capabilities, completely different people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And somehow they made it all work.
You know what that says? Let me add a few more things. It wasn't just us two, of course. They're all together in the military part of the program, about 24 people who became viewers in the project at one time or another over its about 18-year history. You know, and there were probably several hundred more that did experiments for SRI and that kind of thing. What we discovered was essentially that anybody can do this, that it seems to be an innate human capability, and that can be, you know, you can develop the skill that allows you to use it, just like any other innate human capability, that you have the underlying ability, but then you have to, you know, of course, learn how to use it, right? And that's pretty profound when you think about it.
It definitely is. You know what bothers me about that, though, because I've heard that before. I've read it in many books. You can be psychic, or you can read people's minds, or you can. And the one thing that I always come back to is some people are non-sighted. You know, some people do not have the sense of sight. Some people cannot speak. Some people cannot. I imagine pretty much everybody can feel, but you know, some people can't hear, some are non-hearing people. So there are some people who do have senses that are blocked somehow.
Let me say what I say about that. It's kind of like a bell curve, right? You know, any human skill, you have some people on one end who are just absolutely fantastic at it. You know, if you were talking about playing the piano, which I often use as an example, that's the Van Cliburns, to name any prominent Texas piano player. Folks like that, Jerry Lee Lewis, I don't know. Anyway, those are the prodigies, right? Then on the other end, you've got a few folks who just cannot do it at all. And it may be that maybe they're double amputees and can't play a piano, you know? Or maybe it's that they just have no, they're totally tone deaf or something, although even a tone deaf person can learn to play. But anyway, you've got these people on the other end.
But if you have no sense of timing, for example, you would
They might have a problem
with
that.
Be very bad at it.
The vast majority of people fall somewhere in the middle of that curve. They can they can get competent, they can do it well, they may not become a concert pianist, but they still perform adequately so that, you know, they can accompany people who want to sing or entertain people or whatever, you know. And that's the way it is with remote viewing. You've got some who are just knocked down, dragged out, absolute stellar performers. You've got some who just never get it at all. And then you've got the vast majority in the middle who perform to a greater or lesser degree pretty well. If they want to put in the, you know, of course, it requires effort and time and energy. You've got to do a lot of practicing to get good, just like any other, you know, human skill, the complex human skill that takes work, you know. So
really, that's interesting, because then what, with ORVP, the thing that we're trying to run with along with Trinity Science, it's more like, let's all step up to the piano and try and play chopsticks. Let's try.
Yeah,
just give it a try. Get our feet wet.
Yeah.
You know, tinkle the keys and see, you know, see what comes out of it.
Yeah.
And why not, you know, why not try?
Yeah, and some people who have, you know, a sense of tune and tonality and that, you know, they manage to pull something out of improvise something that sounds pretty good. But you'll get a few who don't really have that, and they just kind of make noise, you know.
Mm-hmm,
and so that's
mm-hmm.
where you get sessions that are really good, and you get other sessions that aren't so good.
Mm-hmm. It'll happen, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be cool.
Because I know I'm going to try it. I know that there's probably a lot of stuff that you do that you can't talk about, but what kinds of things stick in your mind about what you've done out of your own body of work? Maybe something from the book, or maybe something from, you know, something you talk about in class or in speeches.
Well,
something that really
is
interesting to you.
Well, gee, the whole field I find interesting. you know, of course, the story I always tell is and it's in the book in some detail. I'm just going to gloss over it really quickly here, it involved remote viewing into the future, and it was undeniably into the future. It was totally blind. We were expecting something else. It was the 15th of May, I believe, 1987. We were doing what's called an open search, which is where, you know, the tasking is actually describe whatever's important for us to know in the next few days.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the tasking is, you know. And of course, I just get a number, but the number stood for that task.
Right.
And I go over sitting there, and they give me the task, and I start describing it, and I get this impression of a large metal structure that's moving through the water, which quickly I described as some kind of, it reminded me of a warship. In fact, it reminded me of an American destroyer. And it's sailing through the water in the middle of the night, and it's in a body of water that's got, it's surrounded by land on all sides, and and you know, going like that. And then there's this impression of an aircraft orbiting some distance away. And at some point, the aircraft drops these two cylindrical objects with stubby little wings that make a guttering, roaring sound, and they fly around, and eventually they come in contact with the ship. And then there's mayhem. There's smoke and flame and fire and people shouting and all this stuff, you know, and the ship leans to one side. And I'm going on and on about this, and my monitor, who actually happened to be Ed Dames, he's starting to get more and more bored, and finally he says, "Oh, you're off. This can't be right." Turns out he was expecting something else. He says, You know, that's okay. You can't be on all the time. You know, sometimes it doesn't work. So let's just go home for the weekend," which we did. Well, 50 hours after I did that session, Sunday night, an Iraqi, I believe it was a Mirage jet, fired two Exocet missiles into the USS Stark and set it on fire and almost sank it. And afterwards, you know, some months later, I was able to get the after-action report and compare it to my session. And my session was exactly, literally correct. The entire, described the entire event. And that was astonishing. That's the most impressive session I've ever done, I think, you know. And it was, in a way, it was accidental. You know, I don't want to take a lot of credit for it, because it could have been any one of my colleagues, you know, some of the better viewers there could probably have had the same experience. But it happened to me, and I tell you, that verified this process, if nothing else did for me. So.
That's amazing. I wouldn't. And how long had you been remote viewing up until then? Because you were training. I read in Joe McMonagle's book that before even sitting in a chair and trying to do the remote viewing, the participants, the viewers had to go through literally like university style classes, and for months, if not years, on. You know, these
not years. We didn't have time for that.
Oh, well, you didn't have time, but it was a long time. And he made it seem like it was hard work. I mean, just like university-style classes.
It was. In fact, I detailed that in my book extensively, but the process we went through. And, I was recruited for the unit in the summer of 1983. That session was done in 1987. So that's, not quite 4 years later is what it worked out to. But, you know, I was doing at that level of remote viewing for probably 2 years before I had that experience. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it took us about 2 or 3 years to get up to snuff, although a lot of that was downtime because we went through some interesting bureaucratic trials. Army got rid of us, and I don't want to go into all that. That just takes, you know, it's just insane. But nonetheless, you know, it's something you can learn, but to get really good at it, it takes a lot of practice. And fortunately, that was my day job. You know, the people who are trying to learn today, I really feel for them because they have to do the same amount of work in order to get as good, but they have to do it as an avocation. They got to have it. They have a different day job. It's kind of like trying to become a musician, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You got to work to put food on the table and to pay for your instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And so learning to be a professional musician, you do in your part-time, you know, your spare time. So.
Well, I happen to be, for some reason, the past two or three Olympics, I don't even know how to say that. Yeah, thanks. I've watched the Olympics, winter and summer. And the athletes from around the world never cease to amaze me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if they go up there and fall, right? It doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that they go up there at all, and that they have put literally. You know, sometimes they'll tell you little background stories about certain Olympic people, and they basically, you know, some of them work at McDonald's, some of them work at a library, some of them work at a skating rink if they're a skater, you know. But they do whatever they can in order to get mm-hmm. that time on the hill, ice, rink, you know, whatever they need, you know, and they buy the time. They pay for this time to do their training. It's,
well, you know, in the
24/7
see,
for them.
Yeah, I see the people I see today becoming good viewers are doing that same thing. They
mm-hmm.
are spending a lot of time and energy in their leftover time to practice this and to get good at it. And so, you know, and it pays off. In the end, it pays off.
Mm-hmm. And there is no Olympics for remote viewing. There's no Olympics for psychic ability or paranormal. But, you know, the effort that people put in is, you know, nonetheless, sometimes on a similar level.
Yeah. You know, I just told you about the session against the USS, the attack on the USS Stark. And of course, that involved future. You know, there's two things that, when you tell them you're psychic, tell people you're psychic, there's two things they always want you to do. One is to find something that's missing, and the other thing is predict the future, right?
Unfortunately, well, most specifically the lottery, usually, right?
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you about the lottery in a moment.
Oh, cool, okay.
Yeah, the problem, of course, is that predicting the future and locating things that are missing are two things that are the hardest for remote viewing to do. It's because it's a descriptive methodology. You can't give addresses or numbers or things like that. You can only describe the setting of something that's missing. And because time, the future, isn't fixed, you can make a prediction, you know, what we call a prediction through remote viewing, about the next, like, say, the next terrorist event, right? You can describe it very accurately, and then it never happens. The reason is because the time stream isn't fixed. There are lots of things that can happen in between that can intervene and detour it away from the event that you might perceive, right? It just didn't happen that way in the Stark situation, and that's why it turned out. But there is a methodology that actually can help you predict certain things. There's a way to get around the problem with numbers, and it's called associative remote viewing. And have you heard that term before?
I've had it described to me, but I've not actually like done it, because I've never remote viewed before in my life. Not yet, but I will for this
project.
RVP, yeah. But associative remote viewing.
Associative remote viewing, abbreviated ARV. The idea is you're able to actually predict the outcome of a future binary event. So what I mean by binary event is, is the stock going to go up or is it going to go down?
Mm-hmm.
Are the Longhorns going to win or Texas A&M?
that kind of thing,
right? You can use it for more complicated outcomes, but it's easiest to see in this kind of binary thing. Is the stock going to go up? Is it going to go down? In currency trading, is the dollar going to go up? Is it going to go down? Right, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is if you ask a viewer, okay, tell me, is this stock going to go up or going to go down? The viewer is going to tell you, and their what amounts to guess isn't going to be any better than chance, just as if they just guessed, right?
Right.
And that involves left brain, right brain interaction, all kinds of stuff I'm not going to bore you with right now. What you do in order to overcome that is, instead of asking them what's going to happen during the event, you don't even mention the event. Okay, what you do is you tell them, I want you to describe for me what I'm going to show you the day after tomorrow, and tomorrow being the day that the stock is going to be bought or sold, right? The day after tomorrow, I'm going to show you something. I want you to describe that for me. You know, let's say it's an object. So you pick a pencil and a hamburger, let's say. The pencil is going to stand for the stock going down, the hamburger for the stock going up. And what you do then is, the viewer then, let's say, describes something round and soft and smells like food. Well, that isn't a pencil, right?
You
buy the stock because the stock's going to go up. Well, let's say that this is the best of all possible worlds. The stock actually does go up. And so on the day following, you hand the viewer a hamburger. You know, you fulfill your contract. You give him that feedback, all right, or her. And that's associative remote viewing. Now, if the stock had gone down, you'd have to hand the viewer a pencil. The viewer would know he'd described it wrong, right? But we'll assume that it all worked well. Okay. So this works. If you're going to describe a target in present or past, it seems that roughly 70-80% of the time an experienced remote viewer will provide significant information that shows that he or she was on target.
Which is better than chance. Much
absolutely.
Better than chance.
Well, way better than chance.
Yeah, way better.
If you try and describe the future, like you're going to predict when the next terrorist event is, it drops way down. The averages that were cited in the remote viewing program were about 5% success rate, which is useless.
You may as well just shake some dice or something. And
that's about, yeah. You might be luckier.
And you might actually do better, yeah.
Yeah. So how it turns out, though, with ARV, and of course you remember you're dealing with a very limited set of events, ARV seems to be about as good as remote viewing present and past. So 70-80% of the time, a good viewer is going to be right using ARV, which if you're betting on stock, that makes you a profit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you're betting on sports events, if you do it right, that makes you a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very, very useful. In fact, I just taught my first ARV class, got 10 folks together and taught them how to do ARV. Some of them already knew a little bit about it. taught them how to select targets, how to set the whole problem up. And then we got even fancier. Our graduation exercise was the Texas Pick 3 lottery.
Ooh.
And in fact, we didn't win it because actually I and the other judges made some errors both times we tried it. But we came really close. In one, the first time we tried it, we narrowed it down to two sets of numbers. We bet on one set of numbers, and it turned out the other set of numbers was the actual lottery. If we had bet the other set of numbers, we would have won that
Ouch.
Time. Yeah.
Because you would have had physical proof at that point. You would have said, look, we did this. And,
exactly.
And
well, that's why I'm using the lottery. It's not to make money, although I'd be happy if we did. The real
right.
reason is you're dealing with an unpredictable future event that is completely blind. Even if you tell the viewers they're working the lottery, there's no way that gives them any information about the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So you have an ideal future event, unpredictable, that if you do succeed in predicting it, you have shown very strong evidence that you have done something, you know, using ESP and successfully done it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of fun. But if you want to, you know, you or anybody else that's listening and interested, they can go up on my website, and I actually have a kind of a reviewer of a summary of what we did in that class, and I show what we did with the lottery and some slides that are on there. So I guess I better give the URL.
It's, yes,
of course,
please.
www.rviewer.com. So rviewer.com. You can get up there, and on the right side, there's some stuff about my next ARV classes coming. But you can click on, I think it's called review of the first one. Anyway, click on there, and it shows you. It tells you briefly what we did, and then it shows you how the numbers came out on the lottery, and it shows you how close we got. So next time, I'm hoping we'll manage it. So.
Well, hey, it's a learning process for everybody involved. This is still a new science.
Yeah.
When where do you hold your classes that you teach?
Mostly in Austin, in
mm-hmm.
Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting, because if you hold one in like August, that sounds really hot to me.
It is. You know, my ideal would be to. You know, up in the Jackson Hole area in the summer
mm-hmm.
and down in Austin in the winter. That would be perfect as far as I'm concerned. But so far, the logistics, you know, cash flow don't justify that.
It's just, yeah, Austin.
If we win the lottery.
Yeah. Well, hey, there you go. When you're actually... I have an idea. Before I get into my esoteric questions...
mm-hmm.
Do you have any hints for first-time people? Because, for example, myself...
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be sitting down, pencil, paper, the target ID that Will posted,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to be remote viewing. And I've never done it before. I've read a couple books. I've talked
mm-hmm.
to a couple of remote viewers. I have a general idea of what I'm going to do. But what about hints and tips?
Okay. First thing is, don't expect it to be a full-blown image in your mind. A lot of people think that. The term is remote viewing. I think that's an unfortunate term. A good friend of mine, Ingo Swann, is the one that coined the term and created the discipline, really. And he picked remote viewing because at that time they were really focused on the visual aspects. Remote viewing actually involves all of the senses one way or another. Now, earlier I said it doesn't involve the senses. That's true. How it involves the senses is the information comes in as if it came through a sense. And the best term would have been for this remote perception. If they call it remote perception, there'd be a lot less confusion about it. But because of the actual term, people are expecting to see this real clear visual image. Here's something to bear in mind. If you get a very clear, sharp visual image in your mind of the target, that's almost absolutely certain to be wrong.
Interesting.
Yes. And it fools a lot of people. Well, of course, part of it, again, is you know, our culture's image of what being psychic is all about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see this TV show Medium on Mondays, right? You know, and she gets these video, I call it video in the head, you know, where you get these clear images of what's happening, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And it's not like that. It's really, and this will be my second hint here, it's really more like getting a half-remembered memory, okay? You know how a memory that you sort of have is kind of vague and kind of fuzzy and it's really hard to kind of grab a hold of it? And yet, in this case, you realize this is not a memory I have. This has come from somewhere else, you know? And so... the impressions are going to be very subtle, very nuanced, and sometimes very vague and hazy. Those are the ones that are most likely to be correct. And so the first flash visual image is probably wrong, but the impressions that you get, the vaguer impressions, oftentimes are the correct ones.
Wow, and I probably would have sat down and you know, if I was sitting there looking at this piece of paper, this blank piece of paper, and I knew I had to put something on it to send a Vance, I'd be like, I see the Eiffel Tower, just to pull something from before,
that's
you know,
right.
that we had
and,
talked about before,
that can be
and start drawing, you know. And, yeah, I probably would have thought, oh, I know exactly what, it, you know, because it came in so clear, you know. But but it turns out that would have just been a wandering memory pulling out of my head.
Yep. Well, here's another hint.
Remote perception. Okay.
In fact, yeah, remote perception is a better term. And sometime down the road, maybe we can overcome this huge momentum and change it, but I don't know.
Right.
By the way, a lot of these old hints, here, put in a little plug, I mentioned actually in my book. So if someone wants to, you know, go through it, I think it's in Chapter 7, where I give a list of these things that they learned. And that was one of them. Another one is that the sketches are often more likely to be correct than the words you come up with.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, what will happen oftentimes is a viewer will draw a sketch, which, when you compare it to the actual target, is remarkably similar in many respects. So you look at it and say, oh, wow, look at that. Yeah, that's a really good match. But what they do is they draw the sketch, and as they're drawing it, their left brain, of course, is observing what they're doing, right?
And it's trying to fill
and
in the details.
And it starts jumping to conclusions,
yeah.
And they start labeling it and calling something different. Now, one really good example of this is I had a student who drew a sketch of a waterfall. The target was indeed a waterfall. He said, okay, this middle thing is white, and over here is land, dark brown land, and over here is dark brown land, and then he labels it highway.
Oh.
But when you compared the sketch, it was very remarkably, you know, in as far as lines can capture it, a very good representation of the waterfall. His left brain had just looked at it and said, oh, this looks like a road disappearing into the distance. And he called it a highway.
That is interesting. So, and that's something that Vance has tried to drill into us. Do not analyze it.
Yes.
Because he says, don't analyze it. That's his job in this project.
Here's a better word to use than analyze. Although analyze is used a lot, and you'll hear me use it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when we say analytical overlay, we're talking about left brain analysis. Don't try and figure it out.
Don't try and figure it out.
That's what people do. They'll draw some lines. They'll say, oh, what is it? I'm trying to figure out what it is. And that invites your left brain to start analyzing and causes all kinds of trouble. Don't try and figure it out. Just describe the impressions you're getting. And as long as you're describing, you'll be fine.
But is there a chance, then, that an analyst, that the person next to you that takes your data, figures it out wrong as well?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay.
When you do double-blind analysis,
and that's what we're doing.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
The analyst will end up often. Well, I don't say often, but can end up having a sort of analytical overlay him or herself, where it looks at the thing, draws some conclusions from how it appears, and decides it's one thing when it's really something else. Now, I'm not quite sure how this works. I don't remember. But is Vance going to have all of his target pool set out there? And then try and see which sessions match.
He's not going to know anything until we know it. He's going to do his analysis before the target is actually revealed.
Okay.
And so he won't know a thing. So he's basically putting, because of the double blind and he wants to do it right, he's putting himself on the hot seat as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's brave.
That's interesting.
But here's what may save him in this case. Okay, the fact that you're going to have, you got 10 before, you're going to get at least 10 this time, I would guess.
Yep.
Maybe more,
mm-hmm.
because now word's going to spread around a little bit, right?
I hope so.
If it's going to work this time, you're going to find that a number of the better sessions are going to cluster around a certain target. The descriptors in it are going to match one particular target better than they match any of the others.
Mm-hmm.
And where one target in and of itself may not necessarily tell you which of, let's say you have a target pool of 10 targets. I have no idea what you got, but let's say that's what you have. And there may be two or three that have some overlapping similarities. The photos or whatever you're using have overlapping similarities. You may have one session that kind of points to any one of those four because it's got elements of each, right? But if you have like four or five really good sessions and they all have elements of the actual target in it, there's going to be a Venn diagram you could draw that would narrow it down to the actual target in most cases.
Wow, that's a heavy analysis.
Yeah.
I mean,
that may have been too much for the radio. I don't know.
No, I mean, it sounds really good. What it does is it overwhelms me at how scientific they've made the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually feels good. Because, you know, we're basically ghost hunters, right? We're a bunch of ghost hunters.
It started
out
as ghost hunters. That's how we all got started in this,
wasn't it? Yeah, we started out ghost hunters. We were going to sit down, and for an hour a week, we were going to talk about ghost hunting in the basement on the internet. Mm-hmm. It turned into a bit more than that, but we kept the name. We really like the name Ghostly Talk. But since then, in the past 3 years, because we've been doing it for 3 years, we've learned so much. And one of the things that they don't have in ghost hunting, for example, and they've tried and they're working on it, is to try and make it a scientific process. Mm-hmm. And evidently the one really good thing about remote viewing is, you know, back in the 80s and early 80s and stuff, when you guys were getting into it, early to mid 80s, they sat down and they said, that's it, we're making this a scientific process, and they did.
Yeah, they actually started trying to do that. In fact, back in the, well, you know, parapsychology as a real science really kind of got going in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
J.B. Ryan, of course, is legendary in that
cards.
Respect.
Yeah.
Yeah, not to say that before then good research wasn't done, but he really tried to solidify it as a scientific discipline. And, you know, off and on through the years, that was pursued. Then with the late 60s, early 70s in New York, there were the American Society of Psychical Research and a woman at City College in New York. I know her name. I'm blanking on it at the moment. Anyway, they were working on some experiments, and that's where this remote viewing stuff originally grew out of. They, you know, Ingo Swann, who many of you probably heard about.
Susan Blackmore? Blackfoot?
No. She's different.
Oh, okay.
No,
never mind.
Schmeidler. Gertrude Schmeidler.
Oh, okay, Gertrude Schmeidler.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking of
Susan
the...
Blackmore, well, that's a different story. She's an interesting person, but she's not in on this part of the story.
Okay.
Anyway, Ingo Swann, through a convoluted process, got involved in it, and he coined the term remote viewing, and he created the first protocol that could be termed a remote viewing protocol. And then some cross-pollination happened. He ended up out at SRI International, then Stanford Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy named Hal Puthoff, a physicist named Hal Puthoff, did an experiment that caught the attention of the CIA, and that all started the whole thing from there. The ball started rolling from there. So anyway, they were attempting to do the scientific process, and it's been refined over the years. There were some problems with their experiments that, you know, skeptics very happily pointed out. The problems didn't invalidate the experiments particularly, but made their results less credible. Well, they fixed those, and over the years, the skeptics pointed out more problems. They keep fixing them, and it got to the point where the protocols are really darn good. Now, of course, the inheritor of all that is Ed May, who Joe McMonagle works closely with,
mm-hmm.
and he's really got the science down pretty strongly here, along with other folks that have been working in the field. In fact, a really good book on this is written by Dean Radin, The Conscious Universe. Last name of the author, R-A-D-I-N, Dean Radin.
Mm-hmm.
And The Conscious Universe, was published in 97, still in print, an excellent book talking about parapsychology in general and the science behind it. So if you could talk him into being on the show sometime, that would be cool.
That would be interesting.
Anyway, yeah. Anyway, so now I've sort of... Oh, you're talking about the scientific basis to it.
Right.
So, you know, this is something that started off trying to be science, but has been really refined to this very strenuous, you know, give-and-take process with the skeptics over the years, to the point where it's pretty well understood and can be done. It isn't always done, but can be done very scrupulously and very scientifically. So.
What's interesting, you mentioned Ingo Swann,
mm-hmm.
and I happen to have read a lot about... Not necessarily remote viewing, but actually about astral projection.
Mm-hmm.
And they had him, when he was at the ASPR,
mm-hmm.
they had him do what he termed at the time, so this must have been pre-remote viewing days, right?
Mm-hmm.
He termed it exterior vision.
Mm-hmm.
That's the phrase that he had used to describe it. Of course, everybody was calling it astral projection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was before OBE even, the term OBE.
Yeah.
So this must have been in the very early days. And one of the things they had him do was, you know, travel to different places and either see a target, which at the time was, you know, pieces of paper up on the top of I guess that was, they were still trying to get their legs, right? So they would write something down on a piece of paper and then put it up on top of a cabinet.
Yeah, they would like do a little sketch or something.
Yeah.
Or they'd put objects in it. What they did was they actually suspended a platform from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would basically strap the guy in the chair underneath.
And then
the person would, they weren't literally strapped in, but they hooked them up to EEGs and all kinds of stuff so they couldn't move anyway.
Right.
And the idea was to show that they did not climb up on a ladder and peek, right?
Right.
And then they'd have their target up there, you know, and then the person was supposed to astrally project up there and describe it. Well, in fact, what was happening is remote viewing.
Right, exactly.
It wasn't astral projection at all. And they just, they were trying to sort this out.
They didn't know at the time what the differences were.
Right. And who knows what the difference is even today. This is how I describe the difference. Astral projection, you have the experience, and we'll lump OBE in here as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have an actual experience as if you leave your body. Maybe you do, who knows, right? But you have an experience that is as if you're out of your body, and you're going and you're having these experiences elsewhere, and you have the sensation that you've left your body behind.
Mm-hmm.
Remote viewing, you're perfectly well aware that you're still in your body. You're not going, you haven't gone anywhere, but you do feel as if you're getting, and you're having these experiences, as I describe them, elsewhere. You know, you,
mm-hmm.
you do feel like you're consciously...
You're getting these remote perceptions of
exactly,
things.
Remote
yes.
perceptions, yeah. And, you know, maybe they're actually just different ends of the same continuum, the same thing going on, just the subjective experience is the same. Who knows, you know. But the problem with astral projection in OBE is that it doesn't seem to be controllable.
Right.
Most accounts of it seem that people just kind of go wherever, and they have the experiences and come back. But if you try to target them on, say, a ballistic missile factory in Tashkent, they're not going to go there.
<You
know?
laughs> Who
so
knows?
That
yeah.
made it useless for government work. You know.
The one story about Ingo Swann that I remember offhand out of all my reading that just absolutely shocked me was that they had sent him somewhere. They had come up with, I don't remember if it was, I'm sorry, my failing memory, right? I don't remember if it was coordinates, I don't remember if it was a like something on a map, but they had sent him somewhere in the world. And he was supposed to describe that place, right? And this was back. This was not when remote viewing was even started. This was when he called it exterior vision. So this was way at the beginning, right?
Okay, uh-huh.
And he described it for them, right? And everything was great, except for he was completely wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until they went over the data, and they said, oh, wait a minute. Whatever we had given him, the coordinates or the mm-hmm. map coordinates or however they had tried to send him to a place was wrong. So let's find out where we actually sent him. So they took mm-hmm. that data, they got out the maps, they got out, you know, things mm-hmm. like that. And he had described that he was just hovering over this large body of water and mm-hmm. couldn't see anything but water. And he was like, you know, I'm sorry, that's all I can see is water. There's absolutely nothing here but water. And they're like, nope, you're supposed to be seeing, you know, some, you know, city or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They found out that they had sent him to the middle of, I believe it was Lake Elizabeth.
Okay, could be.
Very, very large inland lake. And
yeah.
They thought, well, okay, oops, we made a mistake. He didn't, you know.
That actually was a remote viewing experiment when that happened.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember where it's recorded. I think it's either in his autobiography, To Kiss Earth Goodbye.
Okay. Well, maybe that's
or
right.
It's on his online book, Remote Viewing the Real Story. I don't know which one it's at, though.
Okay.
But, yeah, that was actually, that's pretty funny. And there are other cases of other viewers having similar experiences. Joe McMoneagle, famously, they targeted him on, I don't know, silkworm missiles in Iran, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back and reported, oh, there's nothing here but dirt and bushes. So they went and asked the analyst, you know, and they said, well, you know, all he's reporting is dirt and bushes. The analyst says, I know there's something there. We have the satellite footage. We know that he's there. Send him back again. So they send him back again, and he ends up reporting again dirt and bushes, right? Well, it came to find out the analyst had transposed some of the numbers, and in fact, the place they were sending him to really did have only dirt and bushes.
Oh, man.
So that was pretty good.
And, that kind of stuff must happen as well, because we are all human, after all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Just amazing.
And a viewer won't always pick up on that. Sometimes One of the problems, you know, people always, when they're testing the viewer, they'll give them a, you know, they'll put, okay, I have a target in this envelope, right, and it'll be a blank piece of paper, because they want the viewer to say, you know, to prove that they're viewing, they're going to say, there's nothing in that envelope, you know. Well, the problem is that humans psychologically want to please the people that are giving the tasking, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so oftentimes what will happen is the viewer subconscious will go out, you know, find that the target is empty, but the left brain won't accept that. It will start making things up.
Mm-hmm.
It will not accept a null set for the target. And so those kinds of things aren't really fair tests to begin with. And second of all, if a viewer does get mistasked, sometimes they won't report it. They'll just generate some AOL, and it'll just totally be bogus.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I believe that. So, cool. I'll tell you what. We are almost out of time, so
yeah.
let's say your website, of course, Paul, is www.rviewer.com. What's coming up for you in the next year or so?
Well, I'll keep promoting my book.
Good idea.
Let me see the name of that, Reading the Enemy's Mind, and I urge everyone to go buy it. My next thing, I have actually started to have a lot of remote viewing classes. I have been working on a PhD in philosophy. I took this semester off because I knew I had book promotion, and fortunately also I took it off because I turned out to have a whole bunch of clients. So I have a lot of remote viewing classes scheduled, including my next Associative Remote Viewing course, which will be at the end of April. But you can find out about all that stuff on the website. So.
Oh, yes. And how is the book, like, do you travel? This is unrelated to absolutely everything, but I'm wondering, when you make a book like that and then you get it published, do you have to then go do those book signing things and everything? How does that kind of work?
Well, it all depends. You know, very seldom will a publisher, for a first-time author, sponsor a book tour anymore.
Oh, okay.
You're on your own to do that. And so, you know, I actually am working on getting a book signing together, maybe out to the Intermountain West, because we're planning to go out there this summer. I'm doing some stuff here in Texas. I'm planning on doing something in Houston, doing something here in Austin. I'm looking at some other places around the country as well that I'll go out and do maybe some seminars. I have a one-day seminar workshop that I put on in different places and stuff. So, you know, that's what's happening. But, you know, again, I make announcements about all this stuff on my website, and I have an email notification list that people can sign up for, too. So.
That's awesome. How far is Austin from the Big Thicket, which is evidently this area north-east of Houston?
It's probably, I'd say roughly 3 hours.
Oh, okay.
I've not been over there, but, it's about somewhere between 3 and 4 hours would be my guess.
Okay. I just wondered, because that's supposedly an extremely interesting area, and I did indeed spend a night in the Big Thicket once, just on this road called Bragg Road, which evidently is notorious, and they have a ghost light, evidently.
Oh, cool.
Which, of course, you know, piques my interest because, well, I'm telling you this because of the Texas connection, right?
Yes.
But, but yeah, I was down there, and I'm sitting with my brother in his truck on this road. There's we did see a light come at us, but it turned out to be the Hardin County Sheriff. And, of course, he's wondering what we're doing. And so we told him, well, you know, I'm like a bit of a ghost hunter, and here's my card for Ghostly Talk, so I'm not out here drinking and, you know, partying. And he says, one of the most interesting things I think I've ever heard, he said, I've been, you know, doing this beat for, it was so many, you know, years, 20 years, I don't remember, but it was a lot of years. And he says, there has been, I can count on one hand how many times I've not seen something I couldn't explain out here.
Wow.
And I thought that was something. And, you know, so that's why Texas, I have a special place in my heart for Texas, because I was down there talking to a sheriff telling me that there was a very few nights he saw something, you know, did not see something he couldn't explain. And and he's like a tough guy. I mean, we're talking a Texas sheriff here. Mm-hmm. So that was something. You know, I have to say, thank you so much, Paul, for helping, for telling us all this cool stuff about remote viewing and your stories. And, of course, the book is Reading the Enemy's Mind by Paul Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you can probably find it linked up on rviewer.com. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the normal outlets. Check it out. See what you think. And if you have any success, anybody listening, if you have any success or anything, or really, really get into it, email us some questions and we'll see if we can get Paul to come back on. You never know.
I'd be happy to.
Awesome. So thank you, Paul. We have to clear the air, though, because we have to make way for W Paranormal. That's the show that comes up next on Pioneer Radio.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Great interview.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ow. That was a little bit of Ghostly Talk feedback.
Yeah. That was non-friendly.
The feedback, of course. I have to say, that was, of course, Paul Smith of rviewer.com. We do indeed have to clear the way for W Paranormal coming up next on Pioneer Radio. Ghostly Talk is done live from the Haunted Basement Studios in Fraser, Michigan. We're done on Sunday nights from 7 p.m. till 9 p.m. Eastern Time. So we will see you next week with yet more exciting, wonderful paranormal stuff. Meanwhile, stay tuned for W Paranormal. Thank you, everybody. Ah, there it is. Goodbye. See you next week.
Science will not deny the existence of things because they cannot be weighed and measured. It will rather lead us to believe that the wonders and subtleties of possible existence surpass all that our mental powers allow us clearly to perceive.
We must ignore no existence whatsoever. We may variously interpret or explain its meaning and origin, but if a phenomenon does exist, it demands some kind of explanation.
A quote from The Principles of Science, William Stanley Jevons, 1835 to 1882.